Education Podcast listeners, this is Kevin Eva again, the editor-in-chief for the journal. Today I have the great pleasure of speaking with a local colleague, Adam Peets, who is here at the University of British Columbia with me. He's a junior scholar in the Center for Health Education Scholarship, where I work, and associate head of education in the Department of Medicine here at UBC. And Adam, along with his colleague Tom Stelfox, have a paper coming out in the December 2012 issue of Medical Education called Changes in Residence Opportunities for Experiential Learning Over Time. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Appreciate you having me.
It's great to be able to sit down with somebody in person and actually carry on a conversation as opposed to looking at Skype the whole time. But this paper you've really built around concerns that reductions in work hours and any number of other issues might be cutting down on learning opportunities. And it's obviously been a very controversial and hot topic of late. What led you to think that you had some unique spin you could put on the issue?
Yeah, I think most of the reason that we pursued this topic was actually our own clinical experience as we worked in the intensive care unit in Calgary. Over time, we noticed that just anecdotally, we had residents who were coming through the unit that gained less experience and felt less comfortable by the end of their rotation than they did in previous years. And, you know, we certainly noticed an increased number of trainees and didn't see them around as much as we had before and didn't really get the chance to get to know them. So, you know, not only was it an opportunity for us to kind of put more flesh to the bones, if you will, of this topic by exploring it in an objective fashion, but it also allowed us to lay the groundwork, I think, for future studies, because this is a topic that's certainly, as you mentioned, becoming very hot, especially in the United States and back in Quebec, in Canada, and I think it's really going to be an issue moving forward in medical education.
So it sounds like these changes you're noticing have been fairly recent. Is this a long-term trend you've been observing, or is it in the last few years?
Yeah, I think in Calgary in particular, because obviously that's where the study was done, the big trends that we saw were increased number of trainees. The medical school had grown from 69 trainees back in 2000 up to 180 trainees over a four-year period. And so that then translated, of course, to an increase in residency positions too. And so oftentimes back in the early 2000s, we would have maybe two residents on a team type thing. And by the end, we were having up to five residents on a team. And so you can imagine the experience would be diluted a little bit. The other thing then, of course, is change to call requirements or how long someone can work. And that's negotiated provincially, at least in Canada, with each resident's contract that each province negotiates with the resident body. And in 2005, if I'm remembering correctly, there was a reduction in work hours from essentially no limits. You go home after a 24-hour period on call once all the work is done, to 24 hours plus 4 hours. So you had to be gone the next day by, say, 12 o'clock.
Right.
And so there's a reduction in hours and an increase in number of trainees.
Right. And those two things aren't usually talked about in conjunction with one another. I think there's been a global trend towards reduction in work hours, but at the same time, an increase in the number of physicians with shortages being observed in many different places. At a logistical level, it makes sense that you'd almost have to cut back the work hours to manage the greater number of people, but both really work against the education and the expertise of the particular student.
Yeah, I mean, in this paper, I think one of the key things we have to say is that it's just an observation and we don't know about outcomes. What we really need to see, and it's very difficult to do, is 5-10 years from now, how people are functioning in the clinical realm when they're actually taking care of patients, as compared to a previous cohort that went through the training that I described back in the early 2000s or earlier. One would like to think that now maybe it's more reasonable. You know, before maybe people were working way too much and seeing way too much. And now it's back at a level where, you know, you're seeing enough and you're doing enough that you still come out as a competently trained, safe physician. And obviously the system strives for that. But I don't know if the pendulum has swung too far so that now we're not providing our trainees enough experiential learning opportunities to really ensure that once they're out in practice, they are truly competent.
And so what sort of data were you able to draw upon in order to add to the discussion about the issue?
So what we were able to use is a database that is prospectively collected in Calgary on every patient comes through the intensive care unit and also tracks procedures, invasive procedures that are done, and also is then linked to outcomes at a hospital level. So we could follow essentially anything that was done to that patient, where they came from, where they ended up, whether they lived or died.
Mm-hmm.
We also then linked that with the schedules that we had for all of our residents going back, obviously, 9 years, and we're able to determine the number of residents on, the number of procedures they did, the number of admissions they did, and then look at that over time and how it changed. We selected admissions and invasive procedures as two surrogates, really, for all of the experiential learning opportunities that are available to residents, which is a very poor surrogate, but we had to limit our search to some degree.
Can you tell us a bit more about why they seemed like the right surrogate markers for what you had and what you were trying to accomplish?
Sure. I think two things. One, very practical, right? Because we can tell exactly when a patient was admitted and who did the admission. And second would be invasive procedures and admissions really tackle different aspects of a resident's training. We really wanted to look at technical skills because the surgical literature, at least our interpretation of a lot of the surgical literature, is that the amount of operative experience hasn't changed dramatically since the introduction of work hours limitations. But a few of the review papers and some authors have also stated that we're not clear how the other experiences outside the operating room in those surgical training programs have been impacted by these work hour limitations. And so we wanted to see whether or not the quote-unquote operative experience in the ICU or the technical experience in the ICU had changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other surrogate we were using, the admissions, is really the opportunity, we think, where you get the biggest bang for your buck educationally, right? These brand new de novo ICU patients, you're going to be reviewing it with a staff person, you're going to get teaching on it, it's your opportunity to make a plan and really set the course for the entire ICU stay, if not the entire hospital stay, and you're going to have a huge impact on patient outcomes right then and there. And so we felt those were the two best surrogates we could choose.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense. And so one of the things that particularly surprised me was you mentioned you had a 9-year window worth of data, and there were some pretty dramatic changes within such a short time period. Can you describe for our listeners what you take to be the key findings?
I mean, take-home message is that both admissions and invasive procedures decreased by about 33% per resident over time. So, you know, a third of a reduction in the residents' experiential learning over that time period, we felt to be quite a significant change.
Mm-hmm. And no pendulum swing back in sight, so to speak. Do you have any sense as to how you might go about supplementing some of these lost opportunities?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's one of the things, you know, we would hope training programs are already putting in place is the other opportunities for learning, such as through simulation or using more time for academic half day or structured learning activities to actually supplement the experiential learning that they're missing in the clinical environment. And especially at an early level, I think there is much to be learned in a controlled educational environment where you can make errors risk-free. Obviously, I'm talking about simulation and not have that same pressure. But as you get to be a more senior trainee, and even as a junior trainee, you need that clinical real-life example because there's no simulator that can actually depict all the different scenarios you could possibly have in medicine. And it's very different when you've got a family member who's crying and, you know, just distraught because their loved one is dying right in front of you and you have to do something
right in
real life as opposed to something you're doing in a simulated environment. So I think the two are very synergistic. I think you need to have a very structured curriculum for ensuring a broad exposure to all the different aspects, but that's got to be then put in the real context of patient care, and that's where I think a true consultant learns the art of medicine.
At a minimum, I think the data that you've collected speak to the importance of attending to those things. It makes it very explicit and dramatic how big a drop-off there has been. And you alluded at the start to saying that this work was being done in part so that you could start tracking forward. By way of wrapping up, maybe I'll just ask you to give us some hint as to what you see as the next steps and where you're hoping to go with this stuff.
Yeah, I think the key now is following these residents forward to see what kind of experience they have once they're out in practice. And the difficulty really that we've run into is choosing outcome measures that you can follow for assessing competency in practice. And that's a huge issue, and your readers and listeners are going to be far better versed in this than I suspect I will be, but assessing competency and practice is a huge issue, and to choose benchmarks for us, we have to be very careful. We're looking at certifying exams as a potential opportunity as another surrogate marker.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, in Alberta at least, there is a evaluation of competency that's performed every 3 to 6 years for all physicians across the province.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 360-degree multi-source feedback that's done. And again, it's a very gross measure of a physician's competency, but it may give us an idea at least as to trends over time. I think it's a huge area of need to ensure that the changes we're making now in our educational environment are actually what's best for patient care and for the residents learning in the long term.
Yeah. Great. It definitely leaves work to be done, but as I said, it's a critically important data set to raise awareness and continue the conversation about how to make sure that the work is done. So I'll just end by congratulating you on an impressive analysis and data set and paper, and look forward to seeing it in the journal. And I'll just remind our listeners that I've been speaking with Adam Peets from the University of British Columbia, a friend and colleague from the Center for Health Education Scholarship and the Department of Medicine, and we've been discussing the paper that he is coming out in December 2012 in Medical Education, entitled Changes in Residents' Opportunities for Experiential Learning Over Time. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.